Being a more diverse country, many of the nation's schools are not. Decades after Brown versus the Board of Education, Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, and the experiment of forced busing, most students attend schools with classmates who look just like them and live in families with similar backgrounds. Our guest Michael Petrelli writes in his new book that the current gentrification of cities just might lead to a more integrated school system, with young professional urbanites wanting to send their children to racially and economically diverse schools. His book is titled The Diverse Schools Dilemma, a parent's guide to socioeconomically mixed public schools. He's executive vice president of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. That's a think tank focused on K through 12 education policy. Also editor of the journal Education Next. He joins us from the NPR Bureau in Washington, D.C. Michael Petrelli, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Marty.
We also asked Solomon Jones to join us. His blog, The Philadelphia Experiment, is on WHYY's NewsWorks website. He's the author of 10 books, including his most recent novel, The Dead Man's Wife, and a humor collection called Daddy's Home, a memoir of fatherhood and laughter. He created Words on the Street. That's a program to help students and parents improve literacy. And he has a column that appears every Tuesday in the Philadelphia Daily News. And Solomon Jones, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
If I could begin with you, Michael Petrelli, and even begin where my introduction began, which is that we are an increasingly diverse country, but we don't see that reflected in schools, I think, the way we might expect. Why do you think that is?
Now, that's right, that even though we now have a school system that is about half white and half minority, still an overwhelming majority of white students, something like 85%, go to majority white schools. And that tells you that that we still have schools that are quite segregated. Largely, this comes down to residential segregation. Most people still live in neighborhoods that do not have a lot of racial or socioeconomic integration. Certainly, that's the case in many suburbs, but then also in many of our cities. We still have most neighborhoods where there are not very many whites or not very many middle-class, upper-middle-class families. That is starting to change, though. As one author described it, we are witnessing what some called the Great Inversion, where you have increasing numbers of affluent families moving into cities, and increasingly you have poor people moving out to the suburbs, including some immigrant groups that are skipping the cities altogether and moving straight to the suburbs. And that is creating new opportunities for diversity both inside and outside of schools.
Well, let me get you in on the conversation, Solomon Jones. And one of the things that you write about in your blog on NewsWorks is you and your wife talking about where to live and where to send your kids. What has been your experience?
My experience has been that, first of all, the first thing I have to say, and I just
Go
have
ahead.
To say that, is that diversity really is not a dilemma. Diversity is a reality. I think that we saw that in the last election. I think that we see that in the growing numbers of so-called minority populations. And I think that we'll continue to see that in America. And so for us, the choice was clear, that we wanted to make sure that our kids had an experience educationally that was diverse. And it's a discussion that we continue to have. My wife was very adamant about wanting our children to go to a Christian school. I was very adamant about making sure that they had a diverse experience, both in terms of race and in terms of culture and background and religion, because that's the real world. And so we continue to have that discussion, but we are, for the most part, pleased with our children's education to this point.
It's interesting you substituted the word reality to dilemma. Are you saying this is not a problem? This is just the world that we live in?
Exactly. I'm saying that exactly. And I think that, you know, our points of view kind of differ depending on our background. I am African-American and grew up in the city. And had an opportunity to go to great schools in Philadelphia, Masterman for middle school, and then Northeast High School, and then Temple University, all of which were diverse environments. And I think that was helpful for me. And I want my children to have that same experience.
Let me go back to you, Michael Petrelli, because you also write about you and your wife trying to figure out where to send your kids to school, living initially in Tacoma Park, but you moved. How did you resolve this dilemma for yourself?
Yeah, well, so the dilemma for us was that we very much wanted to send our kids to a diverse school, especially socioeconomically diverse. I think in this day and age, racially diverse is easy. I mean, everybody says, look, if you know, I think it's hard to find too many people who would say that they don't want to send their kids to a school that's racially diverse. The question is, when you talk about socioeconomic diversity and you're talking about a school that has to try to serve the needs both of poor children who tend to come in very far behind, as well as more affluent kids who tend to be ready for a lot of challenge, and how do they handle that? And is that something that any school can do well? And that's what I try to look at in the book. Where we end up in is we end up moving, which I have a lot of guilt about and second thoughts about.
I sense that, yes.
Yeah, and we miss living in that walkable urban environment in Tacoma Park, this urbanized town right adjacent to the District of Columbia. We miss it very much. But in the end, when we looked at the schools there, we didn't think that they were able to serve the needs of their whole diverse population very well, that in effect, they were so focused on helping low-achieving kids get up to basic standards, that there was a lot of focus on testing, a lot of focus on those basic skills, and not a lot of the other kinds of things we were looking for in a school.
Which you describe as a kind of progressive education. That's what you were looking for beyond the testing for children?
That's right. And look, like a lot of upper middle class families, the research shows, especially white families, but not just white families, we wanted something more on the progressive end of the spectrum, something where there was a lot of hands-on learning, a lot of art and music, not a lot of traditional discipline, you know, something that matched the way that our own parenting styles were. Well, it turns out that those kinds of approaches, first of all, are not as popular in general with lower income parents. And there's also a lot of evidence that those methods don't work as well with lower income children, that kids that are coming way behind and don't have those basic skills need something a lot more structured. And it's the kind of the best practices for low-income kids are exactly the kinds of things that upper-middle-class parents tend to hate.
Well, let me go back to you, Solomon Jones, and I always hate to make generalizations about groups of people, but nonetheless, if you're looking at the kind of economically diverse schools that Michael Petrelli is talking about, can there be, do you think, a kind of maybe a clash of cultures or a clash of parental styles, or a school trying to manage what perhaps a child who didn't go to kindergarten or didn't get the kind of early enrichment that a middle-class kid gets, that they have a dilemma, in a sense, of trying to educate both these kinds of kids?
I think that, first of all, the correlation between poverty and low academic performance is a lot more pronounced than the correlation between race and economic performance. And so when you look at the fact that 35% of blacks live in poverty, 33% of Hispanics live in poverty, and yet 13% of whites live in poverty, then you see where the so-called achievement gap comes from. And so, you know, it is a dilemma, I think, for the school. But I don't think that it is necessarily a dilemma for the parents. I think that, you know, for me, the interesting thing was that when my wife insisted
that
we send our children to a Christian school, the first school that my daughter Eve attended was an all-black school, and it was a private Christian school that gave her a fabulous foundation. The parents there were not affluent, but the expectations were high, and the educational attainment followed that expectation. The kids who went there were kids who were able to go on to prestigious schools like Masterman or other schools of that ilk. And so I think that it's not about necessarily race, but I think it is about expectation, and I think it's about parents and schools working together to try to figure out how to best educate all the children who attend.
Well, which gets us back to you, Michael Petrelli, and obviously the expectations, the pressures on teachers, on principals, that if you have a, let's say, an economically diverse school population, the kinds of challenges to make sure that all children are going to get a good education.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, look, every public school has to deal with the challenge that you've got kids coming in who are all over the place in terms of their current achievement level. But that problem is magnified in schools that have the economic diversity because again, on average, not always, but on average, lower-income kids tend to come in so far behind. If you're talking about an elementary school, they tend to come in with smaller vocabularies, behind in their pre-reading and pre-math skills. And so they need a lot of help getting up to those basic standards. At the same time, more affluent kids tend to be ready for more challenge. They might be a grade or two or even three grade levels ahead. Well, if you're a teacher and you've got a span of three, four, five grade levels in your own classroom, how do you handle that? Mm-hmm. And it's not impossible. It takes some smart strategies, but it's tough. And I think what I found by looking at this book is that it takes a really good principal, extraordinary leadership, smart strategies. And so, you know, parents, when they're looking at these schools, need to go in and ask the principals and the teachers, hey, you know, how are you handling this? And listen closely to see if they've got a strategy that makes sense. The most obvious thing to do is to separate kids by their current achievement level so that everybody gets to be taught where they're at. The problem is in these diverse schools, that then means separating kids into classrooms by class, if not by race. And then you've got a segregated school on the inside, even if it looks integrated on the outside.
The kind of unintended consequences, the idea that the kids are better prepared will probably end up in a higher achieving class.
That's right. And again, in general, those are going to be the more affluent kids. Not always, but in general. So, for example, in Tacoma Park, I looked at our elementary school, Piney Branch, very diverse place. And in general, the white kids were, and not all just white, but also African-American middle-class kids were performing much above lower-income kids, immigrant students and others. And so if you group kids by those achievement levels, then you're grouping kids by class. Or as one parent said it to me, you know, the kids who live in houses are all over here and the kids who live in apartments are all over there. And nobody wants that.
Go ahead, Solomon Jones.
I think that it goes to the dedication of the parents. And, you know, for us, we are a middle-class couple. We both are college-educated. My wife was the valedictorian of her class. And when we had our first child together, she announced to me.
I see a pattern here, but go ahead.
that I'm staying home.
This is her.
With our she's staying home with our children. And so, you know, it was something that I was not accustomed to. My parents got divorced when I was around 14, and my mother became a single mom and did not have time to help us with homework or anything like that. And we still did well. We both graduated. But I think that, you know, the difference that I see is that with my wife at home, with our children, helping them with their homework, being involved in their school, it has made a huge difference. And it's not about us necessarily being affluent, but it is about us being dedicated.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Solomon Jones. He lives in Philadelphia, blogs at newsworks.org. Joining us from the NPR Bureau is Michael Petrelli, author of a new book called The Diverse Schools Dilemma, A Parent's Guide to Socioeconomically Mixed Public Schools. We have a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Tate Weller, Certified Public Accountant, celebrates 90 years of specialized audit, tax, and advisory services to national and global nonprofit and financial services clients. TAITWeller.com. Tate Weller. Focus. Expertise. Results.
What is Hanukkah? If the answer doesn't exactly leap to mind with the speed of a spinning dreidel,
then tune in for Candles Burning Brightly. I'm Mindy Ratner.
And I'm Bill Morlock. Join us as we listen to the music, light the candles, and eat the food of Hanukkah.
Candles Burning Brightly, a celebration of Hanukkah.
Tomorrow night at 11 on WHYY.
Next time in Studio 360.
Slap it to bass.
That sounded like Borat.
Yeah.
Slap it to bass. Big time.
That's better.
The actor Paul Rudd has a secret weapon, insecurity.
I would say there's been a very awkward thread through a lot
true.
Of the stuff that I've
that's
done
true.
Recently. And that's because that's the way I feel many times throughout my day.
Paul Rudd, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Trader Joe's, traveling the world to source a variety of foods and beverages, like their sweet and tart hibiscus cranberry juice. Locations and more at TraderJoe's.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We're talking about this question. Where do you send your kids to school? How do you decide on the school that you think is best for them? And are you looking for a diverse school, one that might be socioeconomically diverse? And again, our guests are Michael Petrelli, author of a book called The Diverse Schools Dilemma, A Parent's Guide to Socioeconomically Mixed Public Schools. He's executive vice president of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. That's a think tank that focuses on education policy from grades K through 12. Also with us, Solomon Jones. He lives here in Philadelphia, blogs at newsworks.org, author of 10 books. He's also got a literacy program called Words on the Street, and you can read his columns Tuesdays in the Philadelphia Daily News. And we do have a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Michael, going back to you, and your book is a kind of a guide for parents looking for these kinds of schools. But one thing that you say, besides the focus on low achievers that you found, questions about will my child be challenged academically, you also say that a lot of these schools are less safe. Can you expand on that?
You know, this is such a tough issue.
It
and of
is
course
a tough
this
issue.
Is this is what parents worry about. You know, the data are pretty clear that as you get schools that have more low-income students in them, they tend to have higher incidence of violence. There's no doubt about that. The good news is that schools are very safe places to be, much safer than anywhere else for children. So this is really on the margins. So these schools are somewhat more dangerous, but compared to the, you know, life on the streets, they are much safer than anywhere else. So, you know, there is some risk, but it is a very fairly small risk that you're taking when it comes to those safety issues. But of course, that's something that parents are going to have to look at and make a decision for themselves.
But are we talking about schoolyard fights or disruptions in classrooms, things like that?
It's a variety of things. I mean, even if you look at more serious incidents of violence, you tend to see more of that, not surprisingly, in schools that are serving more low-income kids.
Do you think, Solomon, that if the goal is integration on, you know, all levels, and again, we live in a diverse country, we should celebrate that, but do you think the goal is to through an integrated experience like that, that it's good, bottom line, it's good for all children to have diverse experiences with diverse kinds of people?
I think that as we move forward, people are going to have diverse experiences with more diverse groups of people, whether they want to or not. And so I believe that school is a training ground for that. You know, the goal for me as a father is to make sure that my kids have the best education that that I can afford to give them, and that they have a safe experience in school. You know, and I work in some of the most challenging schools through my literacy program and through some of the other volunteer things that I do. And so I've been in schools with where I was teaching a workshop and a young man had on an ankle bracelet because he was on house arrest. And, you know, I've seen in those schools that the kids are dealing with some issues that some of us as adults would not be able to deal with. They're dealing with a parent who's not at home. They're dealing with a parent who's on drugs. They're dealing with raising their siblings because their parents, for whatever reason, aren't. And the thing that impresses me most about those kids is that they still come to school every day. Despite those challenges, those kids don't give up. And so, you know, while I went in thinking that I was going to inspire them, really they inspired me. And yes, violence is an issue. Yes, underperformance is an issue. But there's something about poverty. There's something about not having everything handed to you that gives you a toughness that can't be taught. And so I'm very impressed with those kids and looking forward to seeing what comes out of some of the schools that we tend to look down on, because don't count those kids out. Those kids are tough.
You agree with that, Michael Petrelli?
Absolutely. And as I researched the book and talked to parents who had decided to stay in the city, send their kids to socioeconomically diverse schools, they said, look, you know, their own children who may have been, you know, middle class, upper middle class, that it was really important for them to meet kids who did not have everything they wanted, you know, who did not, who came to school with some big challenges. It was stressful at times, but it was also an amazing life experience for them. And as several people said to me, they said, look, our job as parents is not to make everything easy on our children and just, you know, cluster them off in a place where they don't have any challenges. Some things that might seem challenging, like, you know, getting to know kids who, you know, come to school with all of these you know, tough stories, that might feel a little scary at first, but in fact, it's very good for our children. And it helps them grow up to be more compassionate and to be more comfortable in you know, all of America's diversity as they get older.
But you, Michael, did not choose a diverse school for your children.
I know.
I mean, your book is about the challenges and things that the parents should think about. So, yeah. and you already confessed the fact that you feel a little badly about it. But
I do.
But why did you, what went into your thinking?
Yeah, so I mean, for us, again, it was the two different things. One was the concern about whether our kids would get the challenge that they need. You know, that the schools seem so focused on getting kids to basic skills that they're just worried about whether the kids who are ready for more were just bored, you know, and weren't getting the challenge. The other piece was whether that school was so focused on getting the test scores up and things that it was traditional to a fault. You know, that there wasn't. The art and music, there wasn't the enrichment that we were looking for. You know, we're still early in this. Look, actually, yeah. my boys are still little. They're little. So, you know, we may not be happy with where we've moved to. You know, the fact is in the suburbs right now, there's not a lot of choices. You sort of, you know, try your neighborhood school and that's what you get. The great thing about living in the city, we did not live in the District of Columbia, but if we had, we would have had a whole lot more choices open to us via public charter schools and some magnet schools and might have had been able to find a school that was both diverse but also more on that progressive side of the spectrum, though it is hard to find schools like that. There's just not that many of them.
Well, we should add that Philadelphia has been a kind of interesting experiment in choices, of whether it's public schools or charters or religious or private. Let me go back to you, Solomon. How important do you think it is to have a diverse teacher corps in a school?
I think it's very important. I think that it's important that kids can see role models who look like them, who they can relate to, who they can look at and say, that's going to be me. It's one of the issues that we're dealing with. I have sent my kids to private school. I have no guilt about it at all. but, you know, my daughter... Eve now goes to a school called the Julia R. Masterman Laboratory and Demonstration School here in Philadelphia, which I went to fifth through ninth grade, and it was a marvelous experience in diversity, both social and economic diversity, that I think equipped me to deal with the real world and to excel in the real world, and that's what I want for my children. And so they both started out in private school. Eve is now in public school and doing very well, president of her class and on honor roll. I wanted to brag a little bit. Solomon is in third grade at a Christian school that has a all-white teacher staff, which I have a huge problem with. But we are trying to prepare him to go on to a more diverse experience like a Masterman. And so he's doing very well there academically, right. But we want to make sure that he goes on to a more diverse environment than that.
Michael, you didn't talk about it or write about in your book about a diverse teacher or administrative staff, but how important do you think that is, picking up on what Solomon just said? And then we'll get to our callers.
Sure. Well, there is some research out there that shows that minority kids, all else equal, tend to learn more when they are taught by a minority teacher, which is interesting. It's one of these issues that I think we would all wrestle with, right? Is that it doesn't mean that we want to create schools where it's, say, you know, all black schools with all black teaching staff as a model. But there does seem to be something important about having African-American and Latino kids being able to learn from teachers who they can relate to. So it is a problem if we have a core that doesn't, you know, where we don't have any minority teachers. And one thing that's interesting is that in my research, I found that some of the high-end private schools were doing a much better job on that front than some of the public schools. You know, Sidwell Friends, for example, where the Obama sisters go, you know, that they have something like 40% of their teachers are people of color. And so, you know, you've got some pockets out there of schools that have made a real commitment to that and are able to recruit some fantastic minority teachers. And they say that that makes a big, big difference, both in terms of teaching, but also in terms of the culture of the school.
I was, Solomon and I were talking during the break, saying, you know, I'm sure for some people listening to this conversation, it sounds like a kind of elitist conversation, if you know what I mean, Michael Petrilli, which is that for a lot of middle-class families in cities like Philadelphia, perhaps in Washington, other cities as well, is that they don't necessarily have the wherewithal to make the kind of choices that we've been talking about. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of the effort of the school reform movement in the last 10 or 15 years has been to try to expand options for middle class and working class and lower income families so that they can make some choices as well. And now in a place like Philadelphia, there are a lot more choices than there used to be. But I'll be honest. I mean, the book is written from my perspective as somebody who's, you know, middle class, upper middle class, for other parents who are, in many cases, gentrifiers. You know, these parents who are choosing to live in the city. And in this gentrification that's happening with all of its pluses and minuses. But these, you know, that on the one hand, if we get these middle class, upper middle class families to stay in the city, we can create integrated schools for the first time. Best opportunity probably in a generation.
If the people who live there can afford to stay.
That's one of the issues.
Go ahead.
With gentrification is that as property values go up, then mortgages go up, rent goes up, taxes go up. And so even if you've already bought your house and you have paid off your mortgage, if the taxes go up and you're living on a fixed income and you can no longer afford to pay those taxes, then you have to move out of that community. It's one of the issues with gentrification and one of the issues that I think we struggle with, not only from an educational standpoint, but I think from a residential standpoint. And so, you know, if you're the gentrifier and you come in and you think you're doing this great thing, you know, that's great for you. But it might not necessarily be great for the people who are already there, and that's a struggle.
And that's how you can end up with homogenous schools because of residential issues. And that's Solomon Jones joining us with Michael Petrilli. We are talking about parents making decisions about where to send their children, what they are looking for. And we have a full bank of calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let's see what Delia from West Philadelphia has to say. And Delia, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
I was a student at Masterman and graduated about 12 years ago, and I just wanted to say what an important experience that was for me because it was certainly a much more economically and racially diverse school than I had come from. And at the same time, though, I mean, my parents had chosen not to send me to my neighborhood school for my elementary school. And I was just wondering if your guest could speak to that a little bit in that you see a lot of middle-class families choosing to send their kids to magnet schools, but they will not choose to send their kids to the neighborhood school. And what does that really mean in the end for the neighborhood schools?
That's a good question, Delia. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. And I should say to our listeners, Masterman is in Philadelphia for those who are listening maybe outside the city. Solomon, do you want to take that first? And then, Michael, I'll toss it to you.
It's a tough issue. We used to threaten our kids. We're going to send you to the neighborhood school. You better.
Did you really?
and I have zero guilt about that.
We'll find out what you have guilt about on another show.
but I feel like, you know, we did what we thought was best for our children. Mm. Our children live in a community. They play with children on our block. In terms of their education, I work very hard. And I felt that I wanted to send my kids to the best place that I could afford to send them to. And so I did that. But by no means was it about trying to separate them from the kids in the neighborhood. It was about making sure that they had the best education that they could, because education is the great equalizer. You don't have to break any bones like you do in sports. You don't have to do any of that stuff. All you have to do is do well in school, and it is the best predictor of how well you'll do in life.
Michael, you want to weigh in on that? I mean, this in certain ways gets us to this whole issue about school choice, and I think school choice works for those parents who are proactive, perhaps even have the wherewithal to figure out how to navigate a school system.
Right. And this question about the neighborhood schools, we start to see some changes in a few of the cities that are maybe ahead of the curve on gentrification, like D.C., like parts of Brooklyn, where we've got neighborhoods now that have been in transition for a while. You are starting to see middle class families, white and black and Latino, starting to send their kids to the neighborhood schools again. The sense is that parents, most parents will say, look, I don't want my kid to be the only white student at the school or the only middle class student at the school. But once there's a critical mass of other middle class kids, and maybe the, you know, and oftentimes the way it works is the middle class families will get together on a listserv, or they'll meet and they'll say, okay, if we all send our kids to the school together, then we'll feel okay about it. And that's what starts to happen. And so you start to see some of the neighborhood schools change as well, gentrify, if you will, as more middle class parents come into those schools as well. This is a time of great opportunity and challenge, if you can imagine. All the conflicts that come around, you know, gentrifying neighborhoods play out as we start to see this gentrification in the schools as well.
Let me get to Meg from the main line to join us. Meg, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi, Meg. Go ahead. You're on the air. Hi, you're on the air, Meg. Go ahead.
Okay, great. Yeah, so I'm sort of piggybacking on that a little, I guess. I moved to the area from Kentucky, and there was a court case there that you may be familiar with, right, where part of the issue was the fact that, you know, parents are going to choose quality first where they can, and there were parents who didn't have much choice in quality, and they brought a court case that was successful that said that all children in the state have the right to an equal education, and that equalized funding. And what that did is it changed education for children in poor areas like Appalachia. And I'm just wondering about, you know, that hasn't happened in Pennsylvania. In fact, we moved to the main line specifically because we knew our property taxes, which would be high, would guarantee a better public education.
Well, that's interesting, Meg. Let me toss that to you, Michael Petrilli. We haven't really talked about money, but money, of course, figures so intensely and powerfully when we're talking about education.
Absolutely. It figures intensely. And, you know, some of the people who have for a long time have argued in favor of integrated schools, one of their arguments, and I think this is compelling, is saying, look, when you have middle class, upper middle class families at a school, those families tend to be very good at organizing politically and getting resources for that school, and that they can then put pressure on the school board and on politicians to make sure that they've got the money, the facilities, et cetera, that you need. It is much harder for lower income families working three jobs, you know, all the challenges of poverty, to organize like that. And they often get overlooked and they don't have that same political power. And so and you do start to see that in some places. You've got some of these schools where the demographics are changing. Suddenly you've got these PTAs formed with these more high power families. They're raising $1 million a year. They're, you know, they're putting pressure on the school board. They're putting pressure on the mayor, and you start to see change happen. And that change can benefit both the middle class kids and the poor kids. So that again is part of the promise here, of seeing this move back towards more integrated schools.
Meg, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We're going to take another short break and then get back to our conversation, talking with Michael Petrilli, joining us from the NPR Bureau in Washington, author of a book called The Diverse Schools Dilemma, A Parent's Guide to Socioeconomically Mixed Public Schools. He's executive vice president of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, a think tank focusing on education policy for grades K through 12, editor of the journal Education Next. Also with us, Solomon Jones. He blogs at newsworks.org, author of 10 books. He also has a literacy program called Words on the Street and has a column in the Philadelphia Daily News that appears on Tuesdays. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. As part of a citywide celebration of Frank Furness on the anniversary of his death, PAFA is exhibiting architectural drawings of the Furness-designed historic landmark building. On view through December 30th, these rare drawings document the evolution of this historical building. More information online at pafa.org or by phone at 215-972-7600.
On the next Fresh Air, the U.S. Army's secret chemical weapons testing program. During the Cold War, LSD, nerve agents, and other drugs were tested on 5,000 healthy U.S. soldiers. We talk with Rafi Khachaturian about his article, Operation Delirium, published in this week's edition of The New Yorker. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Health exchanges are a key component of reform, and states have until the end of this week to decide if they're going to organize their own. Also, how the chance meeting of an elderly Holocaust survivor and a young mother sparked a 15-year relationship and a Hanukkah miracle of sorts. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking about a phenomenon. Young urban middle class couples face with a tough choice when they decide to have a family. How are they going to educate their children? Now, some do move to the suburbs for what looks like a better funded public school system with a less diverse student body. But many city parents are wanting to send their kids to racially and economically diverse schools. They believe in the promise of integration, but sometimes finding that school can be a challenge. And we're talking about this with Solomon Jones and Michael Petrilli and our callers at 1-888-477-9499. Solomon, though, picking up on what Meg said calling in, which and even what Michael was saying, which is that if you get committed parents, they can raise money for schools and create a better school for their children and other children that attend that school. But what about the system in general? I mean, it's great when parents are involved like that, but I often wonder about the parents who are not involved like that and don't have the wherewithal to raise $1 million. What do we do about those parents and those kids?
Yeah, I think that is it's a tough situation. One of the things that we noticed about Masterman having sent our kids to private school prior to that was that it was almost like a public-private school in that you had a very involved PTA. You had a very involved fundraising structure. You had meetings and parental involvement and the parents kind of pushing for things to be done at the school. And the school cooperating with that and working very closely with the parents. And so it's almost like a cultural shift from a regular public school to a private school or a public school where you have that type of socioeconomic diversity. I think that when parents cannot get involved in terms of fundraising,
right,
parents have to get involved in terms of being there, in terms of being visible. One of the things that I do here is work with Parent University at the School District of Philadelphia, and you have parents who don't necessarily have financial resources, but they've made a commitment to spend time at the school, which is just as valuable as that financial mm-hmm. commitment.
And Michael, the involvement, the role of parents is just so critical to a child's education.
Absolutely. And it's both what happens at home, reading to your kids and checking their homework, but it's also showing up at the school and getting involved in that community as well.
But I am thinking about, I mean, both of you said this earlier, imagining someone, let's say a single parent, you know, working several jobs, maybe doesn't have a car, you know, all the impediments, I think, for some poor families, not all poor families, but for some poor families to have that kind of involvement or commitment in their school. What do we do for them, Michael?
Yeah, and this is one argument for having these diverse schools, that if you've got all the poor parents sending their kids to the same school and schools that have, you know, 100% low-income kids, then you don't have that same social capital. You don't have anybody there who is, you know, has maybe as much time or resources to do this kind of activity. You know, if you have more integrated schools and so you have a mix of poor and more affluent kids, then at least, you know, you're more likely to have the potential for parents who can be there and raising money and putting pressure on the school system and all the rest.
Does that make sense? I'm sorry. No, go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, and so, you know, so that is what, you know, this is sort of the real politique argument for school integration. I mean, there's many arguments for school integration, but one is that this is a way to push for more equity, mm-hmm. Is to make sure that you know, poor kids benefit from the political power of the more affluent parents.
You agree, Solomon?
No. I think that integration in itself is not a cure-all. Integration in itself is not an answer, because one of the concerns that I know I have as a black parent is to make sure that my kids are in a place where they're going to be treated the same as Little Seamus, you know, where the teacher,
Little Seamus being a white kid,
where the expectations are going to be the same, where the treatment is going to be the same, where the discipline is going to be the same. Because if a child realizes early on that they are being treated differently, that they don't have the same shot, that it's an unfair environment, then that kid is going to disengage. And so for me, it's making sure whether it's an all-black environment, an all-white environment, an integrated environment, that my child is going to have the same treatment as a child from a different race or a different culture or a different economic background.
We could go on with that. Let me get Sean from East Falls to join us. Sean, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I've heard both speakers talk about middle and elementary school, and I wondered if they had more to say about high school when academics as well as social life play such a big role. And I know as a Southerner coming to Philadelphia, the reality is a lot of integration had to do with people, a resistance to integration having to do with people not wanting their kids to date, and that usually happens in high school. So the parents that were interviewed in the research for the book also talking to their kids about dating across lines, dating across class lines, as well as cultural lines. What's going on in the high schools?
Well, that's a great question, Sean. I'm actually looking at Solomon Jones, but let me toss that first to you, Michael Petrelli, just to add to the complexity of our conversation. Go ahead.
Absolutely. No, it's great questions. I'll admit, again, from my perspective as a parent of little kids, I think it's true to say the book is more focused on kind of elementary and middle school. Talk to some people about the high school issues. You know, these issues of on the academics are very challenging, in that, again, you tend to have poor kids coming in way behind, and you have, so they are more likely to end up in the more remedial kind of courses. The more affluent kids more likely to be in the AP courses. And so you look at a lot of these schools that look diverse, on the paper, and you dig into them. And in fact, many of the classrooms are quite segregated. You know, I went to a school outside St. Louis that was a part of a big desegregation program. And I think, like a lot of these schools, you saw not a lot of integration in the classroom because of these issues, not a lot in the lunchroom necessarily. Where you did see it was, on the playing field, in some of the extracurricular. That where there was a chance to interact across these lines of race and class, it tended to happen there.
Well, I should say to Sean calling in, as you were describing dating in high school, Solomon, you went, oh my God.
Well, there's a couple
Go
of
ahead.
Things. One, I have a 20-year-old daughter who is before my marriage, and her experience and as a student and my experience as a parent was different because she was in a different household. But I was very involved with her in middle and high school, very involved. And dating was a nightmare, not because she was dating a white kid, but just because she was dating, period, right?
Spoken like a real dad there.
I mean, I was mortified. And it was an interesting experience because, you know, I think that there has to be a balance socially for kids, and she was very much into the social scene to the point where it was a distraction from her academics. And today, as I drove Eve to school, Eve is 11. She told me that she likes a boy in her class, which is why I said, "Oh my God,
it's coming!
It's coming!" You know, and you know, you want your kids to be able to talk to you. You want to be able to listen to them. And so I listened to her. On the inside, I'm screaming. but I listened to her and just, you know, talked to her about, well, just be yourself, focus on your studies, and, you know, whatever's meant to happen, you know, will happen. But it's an issue.
It sure is. Sean, thanks for the call. Let's see what Mary Kay from Kennett Square has to say. Mary Kay, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks. It's a really interesting discussion. I'm surprised there's been no discussion of how No Child Left Behind has made this dilemma even harder. Because it really punishes schools that have a diverse student body.
How does that happen, Mary Kay? Just briefly,
because
if you don't
mind.
Because
your aggregated test scores look lower. I mean, I'm in Kennett. We have great schools, but we have about 35% English language learners. Right. So obviously those kids face a lot of challenges. I think they've added tremendously to my kids' education. I have a son in college. He feels as well prepared as kids from very expensive private schools, even better prepared. But if people look at our test scores, they think they're low because we have, you know, English language learners. tested on with very blunt instruments. So I think that, you know, something needs to be done to encourage people to be in diverse schools.
Well, that's really interesting, Mary Kay. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Michael, again, I'm going to toss that to you and Solomon. Yep. I'd be curious what you have to say. Michael, go ahead.
No, I absolutely talk about this in the book. This is one of the great unintended consequences of No Child Left Behind. What the law did was say that schools had to release their test scores, not just overall, but also by these different racial and class groups. And the idea was to make sure that we couldn't hide the poor performance of certain subgroups by averages. That's been good in some respects, and actually we see big gains in achievement for poor and minority kids over the last decade. The problem is that what it means is that for schools that have a lot of kids in these subgroups, like English language learners who do not tend to perform as well, they are under huge pressure to get those test scores up. And so if you're a parent, you know, and you say, hey, why is my school paying so much attention, you know, just to those kids and not to everybody else? Well, one reason is because of the incentives of that law. You move to an affluent suburb where everybody's doing fine and passing the test no matter what. A lot of that pressure goes away.
Although, as Mary Kay says, a lot of immigrants in the Kennett Square area, which can make those scores, you know, look probably not as good as they probably should be. Solomon, you want to add to that?
My experience with kids in schools in Philadelphia is that the English language learners tend to be very earnest about their education. I agree that you should not judge them just specifically by test scores. But one of the schools that I worked with over the last 2 years through Words on the Street was Bartram. Bartram is in Southwest Philadelphia. It has a very high rate of immigrants. Through the program, we have the kids write stories. We edit the stories. We walk them through from plot to published what would happen with your story. And the kid who had the best story last year was a young lady named Nyla Khan from, I believe she's from Pakistan. Mm. And so she performed better than the kids who were born here. And I think it's because of a real focus on her education, both on her part and on her family's part. And so, you know, I think that it's something that needs to be adjusted. It's something that we need to look at. But I don't think that just because kids are immigrants that they are inherently going to perform poorer academically.
Michael, we could do a whole hour about the difference between No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top, which is the Obama administration's plan. But do you see the Race to the Top, as best we understand it, perhaps allowing for more diverse schools?
You know, the Obama administration has certainly said some supportive things about school diversity, but I think, like many in the school reform movement, they've really been more focused on saying, how can we take schools that do serve mostly poor kids, minority kids, and help them be much higher achieving, rather than explicitly pushing on the school integration agenda.
Let me see what Joseph from Ballykinwood has to say. Joseph, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
All right. My wife and I worked under the AmeriCorps program in the Philadelphia school system for a year and a half, teaching remedial reading and remedial math, kindergarten to fourth grade. And I agree with Solomon. If you don't have a support system at home, based on what we observe firsthand, nothing seems to work. And the reason I say that, I'll give you an example. We had a little kid that I was teaching reading one-on-one, and it teachers were in a special room. There were like six or seven of us. And he would fall asleep as he was reading to me. And I'd poke him and I'd say, you know, why are you falling asleep? He says, because I sleep with my three brothers. My mama works all the time. So I said, why don't you tell your mom about that, you know, that you can't sleep because your older brothers are keeping you up? And she says, I do. But she says, go back to sleep. And I found, and my wife found the same thing, that if they are in a single family and there is no support available, and I'm not making a critique about whether there should be or there shouldn't be in an economic sense, but these are young women who have kids at an early age, and there's no way that those kids are going to keep up with the rest of the kids in the class. And it was the Bryant School, 60th and Cedar.
Sure, I know that school very well.
The kids were well-dressed, they were clean, the ones that I saw were sweet. When I went into the regular teaching room to see what the kids were doing, and I would say at least 15% of the kids are running around the class like wild Indians, and the teacher couldn't control them.
Well, Joseph, let me stop you there only because we're almost out of time, and I want to just give Solomon a chance to weigh in on that. I mean, we've talked a bit about parental support, but Joseph gave us a pretty vivid example.
And Joseph's right. There are a lot of issues that kids deal with when they come from an impoverished background. And if a kid is the product of a single-parent home, then they are more likely to be impoverished. And so when a kid is in that type of environment where they don't get sleep, they don't get regular meals, they don't have parental support in terms of helping them with their academics, then they're going to perform poorer. They're not going to be able to stay awake because they're tired. They're not going to be able to pay attention because they're hungry. They're not going to be able to keep up because they don't have the support at home to help them with their academics. And so it's very, very important for us to look at those issues as well. Sure. And figure out how we can help.
And Michael, final question to you about 30 seconds before we have to say goodbye. I mean, do you anticipate or see or envision more socially, economically diverse schools?
Yes. I think that because of this trend towards gentrification in the cities, as well as our suburbs becoming more diverse, I think we're going to have this opportunity. And I think that some cities are going to be smart to seize it. It's not going to happen by accident, and it's not always going to be easy. But I do think we're going to have more integrated schools 10 years from now than we have today.
Well, on that note, my thanks to you, Michael Petrilli, for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. The book is called The Diverse Schools Dilemma, A Parent's Guide to Socioeconomically Mixed Public Schools. He's Executive Vice President of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Solomon Jones, thank you very much as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And you can read his blog at newsworks.org here at WHYY. Author of 10 books. He also has a literacy program called Words on the Street. And you can read his weekly column in the Philadelphia Daily News on Tuesdays. Go to WHYY.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, email, the archives, podcasts. Check us out online. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us, though. We'll be right back. And coming up next, we'll be talking about sexual health and sexual education for adolescents.